He'll be discussing the controversy of whether the Book of Mormon is an ancient text of New World history or century creation from Joseph Smith's mind. And we take you now to the chair of the symposium, Ann Wild, who will now introduce Jess Grosbeck.
Welcome to one of the first sessions of Sunstone, August 1994. The session, as he mentioned in an introducing for the radio, for Dr. Jess Grosbeck. In introducing Jess, I've known him for over 30 years, and he's got a very interesting perspective combining both psychiatry and religion in his life, and he's a very fascinating person to talk to. He is currently a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst in the Jungian tradition. He's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry in the College of Medicine, University of Utah, and also the University of California at Davis by Sacramento. He has done extensive research on shamanism and ancient medicine and healing practices, and he also has been engaged in research for a biography on the life of Joseph Smith. His most recent written paper is on Joseph Smith and the Shaman's Vision, and by the way, it will be scheduled to be printed in a future Sunstone magazine coming up. He has been on a mission to America and is president of the Grosbeck Genealogy Association. And before he takes the stand, I still wanted to know if Michael Donovan is here yet. Okay, if you'd like to sit down right. Oh, okay. Oh, I just was handed a note that he'll be a little. We'll go ahead with Jess's paper, and then we'll have the respondent at the conclusion of his 30-minute paper. Thank you.
This paper has been in my mind for some years, but this year I was motivated to put it together because of my good friend Robert Anderson, who in Sunstone will be presenting Saturday on Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. He is Masala, and I am Ben-Hur. We were great companions and friends in medical school, but his point of view of life has evolved to see the Book of Mormon as basically a product of Joseph Smith's imagination and personal complexes and experiences. I take another point of view. I cannot imagine that the Book of Mormon is only a product of Joseph Smith's complexes and life experiences. In fact, I take the view, as Blake Osler has stated it, that the Book of Mormon is both an ancient text as a product of the 19th century. That is, it is impossible for a book of this magnitude to be written without some influences of the writer. But now, without going into the controversy further than that about these two points of view about the origins of the Book of Mormon, I would like to offer a third point of view. And I would like to do it for this reason. First, let me just call to mind some of these things. Why has the book been so powerful? Why, as Harold Bloom has said, is this one of the most creative sacred American books and texts? Why is Joseph Smith our greatest religious genius in this country? Captivated as it has, whether many people have sacrificed their lives and times for it, and it has a continuing, even growing interest. I believe it was number 8 on the all-time best in reading books currently. I think we have to look beyond just those two facets of the book's history and origins to see its real meaning and, as I would claim, to give it another origin. Simply stated, I would like to propose the Book of Mormon as having its origins in the collective unconscious of the psyche of at least two groups of people: the Anglo-European who came to this country and the American Indian. Now, by making that statement, I have to clarify a little bit further what I mean by the idea of the collective unconscious. Carl Jung, that's J-U-N-G, not N-G, the great Swiss psychiatrist, stated collective unconscious was perhaps a discovery. In short, he found that groups of people, individuals, have, as it were, inherited memories, fantasies, affects, feelings, experiences in short, that cannot be cataloged or explained only on the basis of personal experience. Now, without going into further detail in the definition of that, I'd like to assume that definition for you today. Now, if that definition is true, it means that in the end, all human beings have a common root, a common connection, and particularly individuals who may be closely associated with countries and in various relationships. Now, for example, Jung made an interesting observation when he came to America. He found, for example, that this idea of inherited memories and common relationships culturally has a very interesting manifestation in the way groups meet. For example, when he toured factories in Buffalo, he found many Germans working there, or descendants of some of the Germanic peoples who'd come from Europe, and he thought that they had American Indian blood. Some of these options, again, that I won't take a long time to go into, he noted that basically when groups of people intermingle, they begin to influence each other profoundly. For example, he noted that certain Australian primitive tribes asserted that one cannot conquer foreign soil because in it there dwells strange ancestor spirits who reincarnate themselves in this new world. And Jung felt there's a great psychological truth in it. It's as though that when there's a conqueror, the conquerees basically send their spiritual, emotional influences into the conqueror, and that this intermingling becomes quite powerful. And he noted that then as being a very powerful factor in America. He stated you can see it in the atmosphere, speech, clothing, politics, philosophy, art, and religion of a group of people. Now, with this observation, Jung then was highlighting the fact that there's a mutual influence on the groups of people that come together. Now, with that background, I'd like to go into and present a view of the Book of Mormon that may help us look at it a bit differently than we have in the past. First, as Jung noted, this expression of the American religions have the quality and form of American Indian religions. Well, the most powerful influence in the American Indian religions was that of the shaman, or the original medicine man or healer. Now, I think if you study the life of Joseph Smith very much, you find that he fits that pattern very closely. We Mormons have had a rude awakening in the last 10 years to realize that Joseph Smith does not fit the image of the Christian priest or minister from tradition. But he comes up treasure-seeking background with all the trappings of what I would call a shamanic background. That's one of the first things about Mormonism that one notes. Now, if we look at the Book of Mormon itself, it has all the trappings of a shamanic production. An Indian shaman producing a sacred book by revelation with plates. Nowhere do you find it more compatible with certain kinds of forms see in the cultural manifestations of Indian religions. Now, if we look at the preface of the Book of Mormon, we find several important things. It claims to be an abridgment of the record of the people of Nephi and of the Lamanites, who are a remnant of the house of Israel and also to Jew and Gentile. Further down, it states to be a book about Jesus and him being the Christ and the eternal God manifesting himself to all nations. Now, these are interesting claims about the book. It's in this preface that we see the heart of the message of the book. But note now the claim. The claim is, in short, that the white Europeans who came here have the spiritual legacy of Christ and the Bible and the Christian tradition, but also the claim that this same Jesus Christ came here and was the God of the American Indian. Now, this claim has enormous impact, looking at it now from the point of view of the collective unconscious. It identifies and pretends to a knowledge of certain ancestors of the conquered ones versus the ones who did the conquering, that they have a common root in both creations. Now, let me just stop for a moment and hold those thoughts in mind and talk a little bit about what Jung mentioned when he talked about a symbol. Jung described a symbol as a little bit differently than other people who discuss symbols. He said a symbol is the best possible explanation that is yet unknown, but still present and trying to be realized. He pointed out that a true symbol, as it comes together, is something, it's an experience, it's an image, it's an emotional experience, it can be any one of the human experiences, but its function is to bring together opposites that are apparently irreconcilable, or fragmentation that is conceived that chaos could be overcome. He points out that a symbol also, to unify these apparently irreconcilable opposites, must have the ability or the capacity to take the highest and the lowest and include it. Further, he said, the symbol must, if it's going to be effective, be able to redeem and change the original fragment. Now, that's a big order if you think about it. Now, Jung, in his research, has felt that the most healing thing that can happen, for example, to an individual who has an emotional problem or a mental illness, is to have a reconciling symbol, to have an experience in which those things in his or her life that are seemingly impossible to bring together, for example, a relationship with a parent or a child or someone else, an experience in which that was intolerable or impossible can now be not only tolerated, but be brought together to be healed and to be redeemed. Jung talked about the transcendent function of a symbol, wherein it will create almost a new third thing, a new position, a new place, a new experience that will change and integrate that which was seemingly. Think for a moment now when the European American or the Europeans, the white Europeans, came to America. The incredible interface that they presented to the Americans is something we've yet. Think of the genocide, for example, that the European white conqueror committed upon the American Indian. I recall the story of that guide in Peru at Cusco, at the Cathedral of San Francisco, where he described how 25 million Incas were destroyed. The whole religion was undermined and destroyed, and Christianity was imposed upon them. And the genocidal activities in the 15th century really took place as never before. And the story goes on and on. It even goes on to today. What was the problem with the white man accepting the American Indian? Why was it not easier? Why the incredible polarities and conflicts that did occur? Maybe it has something to do with what Luther Standing Bear, a Sioux Indian shaman, said. The white man does not understand the Indian for the reason that he does not understand America. He is too far removed from its formative processes. The tree of his life have not yet grasped the rock and the soil. The white man is still troubled with primitive fears. He still has in his consciousness the perils of this frontier continent. Some of its vastness has not yet yielded to his questing footsteps and inquiring eyes. He shudders still with the memory of scorching deserts and forbidding mountaintops. The man from Europe is still a foreigner and an alien, and he still hates the man who questioned his path across the continent. And I think it's true. Anybody who is a foreigner and an alien does not connect and has the potential to be destructive. But in the Indian, the spirit of the land is still vested. It will be until other men are able to divine and meet its rhythm. Men must be born and reborn to belong. Bodies must be formed of the dust of their forefathers' bones. Again, the allusion to that interface, the land, the people, and those who inhabit the area. Or, for example, for a moment, contemplate the famous last speech of Chief Seattle in 1869, when he was turning himself and his tribe over to the U.S. government, to Franklin Pierce, the president. He stated, "Your God is not our God. Your God loves your people and hates mine. He folds his strong, protecting arms lovingly about the pale face and leads him by the hand as a father leads his infant son. But he has forsaken his red children, if they are really his. Our God, the Great Spirit, seems to have forsaken us. How can we be brothers? How can your God become our God and renew our prosperity and awaken us in dreams of returning greatness? If we have a common Heavenly Father, he must be partial. For he came to his pale-faced children. We never saw him. He gave you laws, but had no word for his red children. Tragically, then, Chief Seattle was dying thinking, there's no way that we could have the same God. The despair, the destitution, the difference, the defeat, it's all written in that remarkable talk. For a moment, then, I would have you contemplate the Book of Mormon as a symbol, as a symbolic bridge to unify and bring together that which seems to be impossible. How did it do that? How does it do that? Well, let's look again at what we just discussed a moment ago. The Book of Mormon claims this strange story that not only is Jesus Christ the God of the Jews and the Christians and those who come from Europe, but he also came here and he is the God of those who live on this continent too. What a strange claim. Of course, there are many who say that was a very 18th century idea. Well, yes, it was, but what an idea. What more can we say about that? Terry O'Brien, in his monumental book called The Return, spent 5 years researching the topic of the white-bearded God of the Americas. As he states, this is a mythological motif, or as Jung might say, an archetypal pattern, a cultural pattern, interestingly, that exists from the tip of South America to the northern parts of North America. It's everywhere. It is a legend, a story that exists in many, many tribes, almost too numerous to be counted. As O'Brien says, in the obscure looms of legend, natives have woven fascinating tales about a white-bearded hero who reportedly walked the Americas before Columbus. Then, after a lot of analysis, O'Brien comes down to the fundamental question. Who was America's visitor? Where did he come? And he attempts to detail he details the stories of the bearded visitor and the culture hero. These seem to be the two broad patterns that he appears in. And then he says that scientific research say that, number one, this bearded visitor, this white-bearded god, could have been someone who arrived from through the Bering Straits to the New World, from across Bering, the Siberian. It could be someone who arose independently in the needs and feelings and patterns of the people here in this land. Or third, that it may have been the extension of stories about a local leader or healer or shaman of some kind. And finally, it may have been from a visitor from different parts of the world. And he outlines the fact that the Vikings, the Phoenicians, maybe the Greeks, many people have come to qualify for that. And finally, he gets down to the question about Quetzalcoatl, the famous god of the Aztecs, Viracocha, the white-bearded god of the Incas, and also of Jesus Christ. And as he is outlining the qualities and characteristics, as he sums them up of this white-bearded god, he lists 28 characteristics of this individual. And let me just read a few so that you'll get the feeling. He was born of a virgin 2,000 years ago in the East. He has a little-known childhood identified with a star. He appears as a holy man and a teacher among men. He is of fair complexion and bearded. He wears a long robe and sandals. He goes on a 40-day fast, and it goes on. And as O'Brien says, one might think that this is a description of Jesus of Nazareth, but it is not. These are the characteristics of this white-bearded god of the ancient Americas. And it could apply to Quetzalcoatl, to Viracocha, and many others. A striking set of parallels. O'Brien concludes with this, that a bearded white man god once walked the Americas is for Native Americans a matter of fact. That Christ is that miraculous visitor is for millions of Mormons a matter of faith. Whether or not it can be unquestionably demonstrated that Jesus Christ did indeed make an appearance on this hemisphere, for there are some demanding and at times bewildering alternatives, one thing seems sure. Jesus Christ, more than any individual who ever lived, readily fulfills the complex requirements as candidate for that white-bearded God of the ancient Americas. Furthermore, the many legends of ancient America, as they have been recorded, clearly support such a visit and thus appear to corroborate one of the basic beliefs of the Mormon faith. But then, after a long analysis, O'Brien then steps back and in his conclusion says in his answer, into trying to honor all the ideas and evidence about who this white-bearded God may be, states this. Our answer suggests and accepts that original native heroes who, except for possible influence from earliest immigrants, exist independently of non-natives. It sees native heroes no outside influence. It does not possibility of foreign acts, but it toward them. If later foreigners are eventually demonstrated to have arrived in the Americas or to have made incidental contributions, or if Christ is convincingly shown to have appeared, no matter, they would merely have been adults, and the basic legends about the New World heroes will not have changed. And he goes on then to summarize that position. So basically he was saying he analyzed all these incredible myths and stories from the whole of these that the evidence shows that from within or without this white-bearded hero, interesting, monumental, and it is certainly the greatest I have seen thus far, we come up with this answer. From Jung's point of view, O'Brien's work would qualify to be what might be called a symbolic amplification of an archetypal idea. That is, taking this idea or pattern or story of a white-bearded God and giving it its full treatment, its full flowering picture. Now, if we take the Book of Mormon, then, as a symbolic story again, what do we have? We have, then, a religious text that basically goes to the very heart of the results of what O'Brien and people like Jung have would interpret. The book that opens the door so that both groups of people can claim the same God. Now, what are the implications of that? Well, the implications of that are that it opens the door for brotherhood. It opened the door for a resolution to the kind of problem that Chief Seattle said was irreconcilable and unsolved. Recall the great statement of the Apostle Paul when he approached the Greeks on Mars Hill. Out of Acts 17, 22 through 26, he said, "As I passed by and held your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly, him I declare unto you." Here Paul was trying to unify the tremendous disparity in the old world. And then he says of this God, this, "And he hath made of one blood to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed in the bounds of their habitation." One blood of all nations. You see, unless you can at least understand, and perhaps even worship, and have some connections with the same God of those who are so different, it's really pretty hard to have very much brotherhood. And so, hen is at the heart of the Book of Mormon, a challenge, an invitation to the idea of brotherhood. A challenge to be able to unite these polarities, these differences in these two cultures that seemingly are irreconcilable. And again, if one considers the genocidal position or the genocidal history of what's happened, one sees that in sobering tale. Now, I recall my own experiences with this book. I recall when I was a Mormon missionary in 1955 and went to Central America and into Guatemala. And I remember one night, far in the hills of Guatemala, we ran into a man who traveled through the week, a humble Indian, who worked himself to the bone to support his family. And in the candlelight, we told our story of the Book of Mormon. And I doubt I will never forget, I know I will never forget his response, the light in his eyes, as he said, "All my life I have wanted to know who my ancestors were." And of course, it is a mystery what happened to the Mayas, where they came from, and so forth. And when I saw the light in his eyes, when he heard the story of the Book of Mormon and what it pretended to be, such a transformation I had never seen. I recall that night that we walked for 2 hours back to get a copy. So I shall never forget how not only did he affect me, but I affected him. I opened myself as a young, naive, egotistical, narcissistic American young boy, thinking I knew everything that was right, to a new culture. This wasn't just a one-way process in which I was giving him something. He gave me something, as my mission experience proved to be the case. An interchange, an understanding of cultural views, of ideas, of differences into my soul. And so what we were able to exchange in that night symbolized what my experience in working and living in that country was. And all of that, I believe, came because of the Book of Mormon. For what it is, for what its power is, to be able to transform and change the lives of people. Now, I recall, too, that the famous Black Elk, an American Indian shaman, in his famous vision at Harney Peak, said this. When he saw the hoops of the world, he said, "I saw more than I can tell, and I understood more than I saw. For I was seeing in a sacred manner the shapes of all things in the spirit, and the shape of all being." See, here again in his vision, here was a different vision than some of the other Indian shamans. This one is similar to the Book of Mormon, the bringing together of various groups, of how people must come together to be able to live together as one. And to me, that's what the Book of Mormon does. Now, again, I would present to you the idea. Where does this book come from? Where is its origins? I think from my own studies, as I say, I think Jung would say this, that it truly is a product of a collective. It's a product that goes beyond the personal history of Joseph Smith. He spoke like the history. He articulated something that will help. He spoke, as it were, from the very roots of the beings of these two cultures, and what a symbol it is for all the cultures in conflict. I personally feel that's why the Book of Mormon is a book to interest and captivate peoples all over the world. But certainly this is its basic history. Think too now again as you read 3 Nephi in chapters 11 and 12. When Jesus presents himself and he says to the Nephites in that remarkable visitation, "I am Jesus Christ. I am the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob." And as he goes on to describe it, "I am God of the whole world." And he is the God of the peoples of this land, as he speaks to the Nephites, as we know he was a God to the peoples in the old world. And what a moving story it is as 3 Nephi unfolds. Now, when my good friend Masala speaks on Saturday, you'll hear a different story from about 3 Nephi. But I want you to remember this one. Indeed, it is a book for our time. Now, I'd like to close by just mentioning that not only did Chief Seattle talk about the despair of his own people at that time, but he gave us a warning. "We know that the white man does not understand our ways. Our portion of the land is the same to him as the next, for he is a stranger who comes in the night and takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy, and when he has conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's graves and his children's birthright are forgotten. The sight of your city pains the eyes of the red man. There is no quiet place in cities, no place to hear the leaves of spring or the rustle of insects' wings. I recall with a good friend of mine, Diane, last week, we traveled in Washington, and we saw a sign that said, 'Drive quietly, lark singing.' When's the last time you saw a road sign like that? There is no quiet place in white men's cities. The clatter only insults the ears. And the beasts and the trees as they die." He goes on and talks about that. He then states, "It matters little where we pass the rest of our day, that many. A few more hours, a few more winters, and none of the children of the great tribes that once lived on or that roamed in small bands in the woods will be left to mourn the graves of the people once as powerful and hopeful as yours. The whites, too, shall pass, perhaps sooner than other tribes. Continue to contaminate your bed, and you will one night suffocate in your own waste. When the buffalo are all slaughtered and the white horses are all tamed, the secret corners of the forest heavy with the scent of many men, and the view of ripe hills blotted by talking wires, where is the thicket gone? Where is the eagle gone? And what is it to say goodbye to the swift and the hunt and the end of living and the beginning of survival? It is my message to you that the Book of Mormon, as a symbolic story of our two peoples, is a very relevant book, and a book whose time truly has come. Thank you very much.
Mr. Donovan? We're glad Mr. Donovan has arrived, and I'd like to invite him to come up now. While he's coming, Michael Donovan is a displaced Irishman, having been born in Ireland, raised there, and graduated from seminary there to become a Catholic priest. The path from Ireland to Price is a rather improbable journey, and how and why Michael took it, only Carl Jung can tell. He was a parish priest for years, ministering to the coal mining community. During his service here, he came under the tutelage of Father Gregory Santos, a Jungian analyst of sorts at the Huntsville Monastery. Michael is an explorer of Irish folk and myth from a Jungian perspective, and recently dreamed that he had a phone call inviting him to respond to Jess's paper at Sunstone. So we are giving him the opportunity now of fulfilling that dream.
I wish you, they say never open a talk with an apology, but I feel that I do need to apologize to Dr. Grossbeck and to all of you here for not being on time. The dream apparently told me to be here at 10 o'clock, and so... So there it is. I did have an amplification of that dream at about 9:15, however, telling me to pronto. On August 15th, 1994, Gary, at an AA meeting somewhere in the Salt Lake Valley, celebrated his third birthday of sobriety. 1,100 days of sober living, one day at a time. As is customary, he told his story. He related how he had for 20 years lived the life of an alcoholic and cocaine addict, how he had lost 3 jobs, how he had brought himself close to financial ruin, how he had lost one marriage and was about to lose another. He described in graphic detail the process of addiction up to and including a denial so extensive and pervasive that despite all evidence to the contrary, he did not have a problem. He described how he was shanghaied into treatment by his 2 brothers, bodily carried into Day Spring at LDS Hospital, which he then described as a penitentiary. Upon arrival there, when he saw what to do to be sober, he wanted nothing to do with it. Despite the physicality of brothers, the entreaties of sisters, the caveats of psychologists, social workers, doctors, and nurses, he was leaving. At that time, the elevator at LDS Hospital opened directly onto the Day Spring unit, and he pressed the buzzer to go down. He waited impatiently for the elevator to arrive, and when it did, his 6-year-old daughter stepped off the elevator, carrying in her hand a big handwritten card that said, "Thank you, Daddy, for seeking help in the hospital." His ego was robbed of its negative power, and the process of recovery was started, culminating in 1,100 days of continuous sobriety. He noted that he raised the power story, first of himself, for himself and for others, to the extent that in his own recovery process, he liked to spend at least one of the meetings he attended extensively of the great number of people who were beginning the early stages of sobriety. At the simplest terms, it is apparent to all of you that this man has come in contact with some kind of healing stereotype or archetype. This currently has particular meaning for himself and the kind of associative impact on his life and his immediate community. The I has become we for him, which is always a step in the right direction, as analysts will always know, especially since I had distinct memories of this man's story last year, which touched on much of the same material, but emphasized that the telling point for him then was the focus for change was that he was ready to give it up, that he to the end of the road. The I, the ego, was still pretty much involved. Let us suppose for a moment that this man's story was thought worthy sometime in later time to be included in some kind of scripture. The interpretation of that scripture would necessarily involve certain things. It is likely that it would initially involve questions that would be asked, like, who wrote it? What actually happened? When and where was the author at the time of writing? Who were in the audience, and what was the author's purpose in writing all of this? It then would proceed, if the analysts got a hold of it, to identify individual stereotypes, or archetypes, in that particular story. And if you look at them very, very clearly, not alone is there a healing stereotype or archetype, there is also a feminine, that the agency of healing comes from the feminine side. And again, there are stories all over the world that make precisely this point. So what is it doing in the story of a man of the 20th century? There's also the possibility that in his heroic journey, he was confronted with the same general dilemma that Agamemnon went to the city of Troy. He, before he set out on this heroic journey to rescue his wife Helen, he prayed to the gods of war and offered them up the first thing of his own that would come his way. The thing that came was his three-year-old daughter, whom he offered in sacrifice to the god of war. There or not? Maybe. But this, and many other examples, is the necessary process by which things are processed in this world of archetypes, and the Book of Mormon, and all the biblical scriptures throughout the world. What is the point of all of this? To make it somewhat briefly, the point is that Dr. Grosbeck's paper may bring out a valid expression of a unifying archetype, but may miss the mark if it's not interpreted in at least three different ways. One, I put it to Dr. Grosbeck that the best thing that the LDS Church has going for it is the vision of Joseph Smith. That there can be disagreement over whether the Mormon is a valid expression of, a valid archetype. But there can be no disagreement by anybody that something happened transcendental nature in 18th and 19th century America. And there must be no stepping away from that reality. Also, too, the Book of Mormon must be interpreted in the way that the church has become in the 20th century. I can ask all sorts of questions about that, but they're not mine to ask. I will ask one. Why did, if it was rejecting a European form of religion, did it adopt almost from the earliest days down to its almost last detail the formula of the Roman Catholic Church? Why did that happen? It is a question for now and must, you know, always be interpreted that way. It also must be interpreted in the light of the psychic experiences of guys like Gary. Why has it chosen to exclude or exclusively have the transcendental process take place in an upper room and exclusively the role of the prophet? There may be no necessary contradictions, but the question must be asked and asked significantly. That question must be asked. You know, and these are the kinds of things that Joseph Smith, you know, and all of these things. There are many, many more. I do feel a certain pressure of time, but I want to get on with another point I wanted to make. But there are a lot of questions, but the questions must be asked in the terms of the spiritual experiences of latter-day people, modern 20th century people, in the light of also to what has become in its organization. It is a matter, when I first came to the Valley, for example, in 1967, I could come straight from 45th South and have a perspective of the temple. It was, you know, something that I could say uniquely was Salt Lake City. That vision no longer exists. It has been replaced by the vision of the administration building of the LDS Church. So, this is the stuff of Jungian analysis. You know, these are the questions certainly asked. I want to focus a little bit on some of my own work with Irish tales, more or less to show that sometimes archetypes will form certain relations, you know, for a specific purpose at a specific time. In a number of these Irish stories that I deal with, they start out in the classic heroic form. There's usually, in these hero tales, a man or a young boy about to become a man, almost exclusively with his mother. There's very little of the father figure there. And he goes on his heroic journey, and for some reason, in a vast majority of them, or in a significant majority of them, he always ends up back the mother. Now, this is no surprise to psychiatrists and to analysts, because it happens to all men to some extent when they hit their 40s. But nevertheless, the Irish, in some of its psychic stuff, is stuck, or was stuck, in this particular place. Now, again, the questions have to be asked, and one could say that for some reason, it became important for society to do it in precisely that way. But perhaps it's time to move on. There is, as I say, a particular sadness associated with that, and it is indicative of some psychic illness at the heart of Irish society. And God knows you probably don't need too many symptoms to see that that could possibly be the case. A further amplification of this story is found in the movie The Widow's Peak, currently playing in here and not too very far away from here. It describes a place where there are no men, except for the son dowager widow, who has made this place into and the exclusive realm of widows. And where the greatest social event is on Sunday after Mass, where they go and place flowers on the graves of their husbands. In this place, there is a spinster who is living there by accommodation. She has no money. She has no standing. She has no power. And another young widow is individual to the group that proves to be disastrous. You know, she comes into this group and proves to be disastrous. For the male. In this particular evocation of this story, the male is kicked bodily out of the house, and he has to get his feet wet once again, and he has become the captain of a very small boat on a lake just outside his house. It seems disastrous, it seems like it's chaos, but the psychic process goes on regardless. What does this do? The progress of the psychic power is, in fact, progress. It's not perfection. And so this tells me that in bringing this into relationship with the total world, again, certain questions must be asked. Why did the early church, meaning the LDS church, adopt a 4th century version of the Trinity? There are problems, admittedly, with the Trinity. Carl Jung expressed them deeply, but its validity as an archetype is in the terms expressed generally by the Roman Catholic Church is valid. So why did the church adopt a 14th century version of that? To enter into the world, one must confront certain archetypes. This is one of them. Also, too, why did, right after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, there was a rending of the veil of the temple. The understanding of that rending of the veil, that the divine was open to all men, not just to the exclusive provenance of a priest or any particular tribe or anything else like that. It was directly accessible by all men. Why did the church put it back behind veils? Why did that happen? And for what reason? And for what accommodation? Why, in its accommodation with the Trinity, did it not avoid some of its negatives? The negatives for Carl Jung was basically a problem he had with his father, who could only explain it in terms of faith alone. You're not supposed to understand this. You're supposed to take this on faith. And he found that totally revolting, which it is. He also found trouble in that it served, for the most part, the exclusive patriarchy of the current church and allowed no element of the feminine in. Nevertheless, It was recognized as an architect. And it was no small joy on the part of Carl Jung that in 1948, for no apparent reason, Pope Pius XII proclaimed that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was assumed body and soul into heaven and established a quaternity, which was a better balance as far as he was concerned. You know, these are the thorny questions of, and I do not wish to, I offer my comments not as a contradiction to what Doctor has said, but more or less as a companion volume, because these are the things that must be asked if one is to enter into, you know, the world kind of view. Okay. All I want to say is this, and it's a somewhat of a little joke, that in this same movie, The Widow's Peak, the psychic process continues. Because as a result of this story, and I counsel all of you to see it, there is a mother who has a husband. She has a daughter who also, after kissing a lot of frogs, has found a prince. And they're on a boat, and there is a possibility that they're headed for the United States. Thank you.
We'd like to thank both of our presenters. We do have a few minutes left. If any of you have any questions, there's a microphone provided in the center of the room. And if you'd like to step up and address your question to either of the presenters, I'm sure they'd be glad to answer them. So do we have any questions at this time? Okay.
Yeah. I would like to ask Michael Donovan if he was impressed by what Dr. Grosbeck had to say about the Book of Mormon being a unifying area where the Indian and the white man can worship the same God. I was impressed by what he presented there, and I was really excited about it because I'd never heard that angle before. And the Indian chief, LaSalle, was bemoaning and weeping practically over the fact that there was no concept of being able to be together, where the Book of Mormon has presented that possibility beautifully.
Even though I was late, I had read Dr. Grosbeck's paper and had, you know, fairly basically endorsed as valid, you know, the broad lines of his argument, if that's the word to use. My LDS friends told me I was supposed to be nice to you guys. So. And so my core point is this, is that I can in say heartily endorse that this certainly is a valid archetypal material whose primary purpose is for LDS people right now, and that for it to enter into the world body, it needs to do some further work. Again, along the lines and questions that I talk about, because in Jungian psychology, especially, and in Jung's commentary on the hermeneutics of the Bible, he raises those very. It has to be interpreted in terms of current psychic experience, the present experience of the church, and also the primary vision of Joseph Smith, I feel.
Thank you. One more question, please. That's probably all we have time for.
I'd like to address this question to Jess Grosbeck. I understand your praise for Third Nephi as a unifying text for as you, what you call brotherhood. But as an archetypal text, from this Jungian perspective, how would you interpret a couple of things that are prominent in the Book of Mormon, such as, first of all, the constant intrafamilial genocidal warfare going on? What does that say about Native American people? And secondly, what about its near exclusion of women? And how do those two themes fit into your theory of the Book of Mormon as a unifying text?
Those are very good questions. I think Hugh Nibley has answered the first question very well. I think, again, the Book of Mormon, with the stories of the genocidal conflicts between the various groups, again, is a magnificent reflection of the kinds of stressors that we face. And but also in those genocidal tales, those familial and nation tales, are means and approaches by which those differences can be resolved. Again, I think it's like any truly powerful symbol. It will have both the conflict, the irreconcilable conflicts, seemingly, with the resolution. That would be my response to the first question. The second question, I think I will divert, because I'm doing some work on that right now. Carolyn Pearson challenged me about this business of the women in the Book of Mormon, and it is a big issue, but I'd rather not say anything about that until I have more time. Thank you.
Do I see another paper in the making here? Okay, that will conclude this session. Thank you very much for coming.
To Dr. Jess Grosbeck with a paper that he titled Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon, The Archetypal Connection, A Basis for Faith in a New World. And he was responded to by Michael Donovan, a former Catholic priest, originally from Ireland, now in Price, Utah, and also a student of Jungian psychology. Dr. Grosbeck looked at the Book of Mormon from a Jungian perspective and enlarged on the concept of the Book of Mormon being from a reflection of the life of Joseph Smith. Michael Donovan enlarged further on that idea by comparing the life of a reformed alcoholic and his psychological experiences to experiences of Joseph Smith and other psychological experiences. We invite you to tune in again in about 15 minutes. We'll be starting another session, and just a reminder that tapes of all these sessions are available along with other sessions that are not being broadcast. And for more information about those tapes, you can call the Salt Lake Hilton and ask for the Sunstone Desk. The number is 532-3344.